Broadcasting around the world from the desert metropolis of Phoenix, Arizona, this is The Dividing Line. The Apostle Peter commanded Christians to be ready to give a defense for the hope that is within us, yet to give that answer with gentleness and reverence. Our host is Dr. James White, Director of Alpha and Omega Ministries and an elder at the Phoenix Reformed Baptist Church. This is a live program, and we invite your participation. If you'd like to talk with Dr. White, call now at 602-973-4602 or toll-free across the United States. It's 1-877-753-3341. And now with today's topic, here is James White.
And welcome to The Dividing Line on a Tuesday morning. Good to be with you. I was given an URL that I looked at last night that once again for our brothers and sisters over in the United Kingdom cannot be good news, but obviously what starts there comes our direction, and there are lots and lots and lots of radicals in our own nation of the United States that would like to see this, would applaud this greatly. This is from the Daily Mail from the 24th of October. Title, Foster Child to be Taken Away Because Christian Couple Refuses to Teach Him About Homosexuality. They are devoted foster parents and an unblemished record of caring for almost 30 vulnerable children. But Vincent and Pauline Mathrick will this week have their latest foster son taken away because they have refused to sign new sexual equality regulations. To do so, they claim, would force them to promote homosexuality and go against their Christian faith. The 11-year-old boy, who has been their care for 2 years, will be placed in a council hostel this week, and the Mathericks will no longer be given children to look after. The devastated couple, who have 3 grown-up children of their own, became foster parents in 2001 and have since cared for 28 children at their home in Chard, Somerset. Earlier this year, Somerset County Council's Social Services Department asked them to sign a contract to implement Labor's new sexual orientation regulations, part of the Equality Act 2006, which make discrimination on the grounds of sexuality illegal. Officials told the couple that under the regulations, they would be required to discuss same-sex relationships with children as young as 11 and tell them that gay partnerships were just as acceptable as heterosexual marriages. They could also be required to take teenagers to gay association meetings. When the Mathericks objected, they were told they would be taken off the register of foster parents. The Mathericks have decided to resign rather than face the humiliation of being expelled. Mr. Matherick, a 65-year-old retired travel agent and a primary school governor, said, I simply could not agree to do it because it is against my central beliefs. We have never discriminated against anybody, but I cannot preach the benefits of homosexuality when I believe it is against the Word of God. Mrs. Matherick, 61, said they had asked if they could continue looking after their foster son until he has found a permanent home, but officials refused, and he will be placed in a council hostel on Friday. She said, he was very upset to begin with. We were all very close, but he's a mature young man, and he's dealing with it. The couple, who have 6 grandchildren and 1 great-grandchild, are both ministers at the nonconformist South Chard Christian Church. When they first started fostering, they took in young single mothers and their babies. More recently, they have been caring for children of primary school age. Mr. Mathericks added, it's terrible that we've been forced in this corner. It just should not happen. There are not enough foster carers around anyway. Without these rules, they were saying that we had to be prepared to talk about sexuality with 11-year-olds, which I don't think is appropriate anyway, but not only that, to be prepared to explain how gay people date. They said we would even have to take a teenager to gay association meetings. How can I do that when it's totally against what I believe? Religious campaigners say the couple are the latest victims of an equality drive which puts gay rights above religious rights. Christian, Jewish, and Muslim leaders have complained that the rules force them to overturn long-held beliefs. The Mathericks are planning to fight their case in the courts with the backing of the Lawyers Christian Fellowship. The same organization is backing Christian magistrate Andrew McClintock, who resigned from the family courts in a row over gay adoption. He says he was forced to resign because he was not allowed to opt out of cases where he might have to send a child to live with gay parents. The Mathericks case comes at a time when there is a chronic shortage of foster parents who work on a voluntary basis. An extra 8,000 are needed to plug the gaps in the service. Researchers have found that continually moving children from home to home can have a devastating impact on their education and general welfare. But a report last year revealed that the shortage of carers meant that some children in care are being forced to move up to 3 times a year. David Taylor, Somerset County County Council's Corporate Director for Children and Young People, said no decision has been made about the deregistration of Mr. and Mrs. Matherick. The council is committed to promoting the interests of children and young people and welcomes foster carers from all backgrounds and faiths. Yeah, as long as you believe in Uber rights for homosexuals. That's what's heading our direction.
I love how they describe the church as nonconformist.
Well, that's an actual technical term in regards to the Church of England. So,
oh, okay. American here, but
yep.
But in fact, it describes them obviously in this situation well, in that they are not conforming to the secularization and whatever else you want to call whatever's happening to that.
That's not so much even secularization as it is the establishment of Uber rights based upon sexuality. It is absolutely an incredible thing, and it's coming our direction. Yeah. There are all sorts of people. We see this. We saw this last week in California with the signing of legislation into law by Arnold Schwarzenegger. And it is the only thing I can hope is eventually people, because the vast majority of people find homosexuality reprehensible, and eventually, you know, as long as it's somebody else, they'll go, oh, well, I'll be open-minded about it. Even the sinner gets tired of having things just shoved down his throat this. And the only thing I can hope for is a backlash to where you go, wait a minute, that's enough of that. We're not granting rights based upon how you have sex, okay? That's the if anything shows the degradation of a society over time, it's when you start basing rights upon sex. That's it just doesn't get any worse than that. So our societies are in a moral free fall, and this is the result. And of course, this is so plain. The what's best for this child here is not what matters. It is the promotion of Uber rights for homosexuality. That's all that matters. What's right for these children doesn't matter. And there is an implicit moral assertion that what is best for children is to teach them about homosexuality and to adopt one particular worldview that says homosexual marriages are equal to heterosexual marriages. There's no such thing as a homosexual marriage. And for a Christian, there can't be. Jesus Christ made it very, very plain what a marriage is. And so what the society, what the British government has decided it has the authority to do, and it will answer to God for this, is to tell Christians that you must disbelieve what Jesus teaches you about marriage so that we can have the political power of homosexuals. That's what the British government has done, and God will not be mocked. Was there something you wished? Okay, then you need to take your hand off of that off of that button and move the microphone away, because that's the indication that you have something to say. It depressed me to read that article, but and maybe it depresses you to read that article, but and to have it read to you. But we need to know what is going on out there, and we need to know what these people are doing, and it needs to be said clearly and openly. This is, you know, they always try to put this in the context of putting the Christian on the defensive and saying you're the one who is being closed-minded here. These people do not want free speech for anyone but themselves. They do not want anyone. I'm happy to debate. I've done three debates on homosexuality now. One against a homosexual, one against Barry Lynn, one against John Shelby Spong. I don't have any problem doing that, because I will say up front right now, I destroyed every person I debated on the subject. It wasn't even close. It wasn't even, it's barely, you could barely call it a debate. I mean, there's their worldview cannot survive examination. So I don't have any problem with them having the ability to present their perspective. They are the ones that have a problem with my being able to say that's evil. And that's what's going on in our society. And it's, let me tell you, these things may seem like they're a long ways away, because that's the United Kingdom. It's not that long an airline flight. It really isn't. You go to sleep, you wake up, you're there. And unfortunately, that pond is not much of a wall against that kind of stuff, the stuff that I've mentioned on the blog, the stuff going on in Sweden, where religious schools are being prohibited from being able to say that what they are teaching is true. Now, it's initially meant against Islamic schools, you know, that you can't say the Quran is true. But that also means Christians can't say the Bible's true. Europe has become a secular state, and that secularism is not going to be able to stand for very long against Islam. Just not going to be able to do it. Everybody knows that on a simple matter of reproduction, the number of children that Islamic immigrants to those other nations are having is so far beyond 4, 5, 6 times beyond the number of children being had by the native populations that secularism will crumble after trying as best it can to establish itself, and it's just not going to be able to do it. 877-753-3341. 877-753-3341. We already have a phone call, and I believe this is from Stephen up in Toronto. Hi, for some reason I hit air, and nothing happens. And click, something happened. Hello, Stephen.
Yes, how are you, Dr. White?
Well, needing to figure out why my clicker ain't working anymore.
You just clicked one too many times, maybe.
Okay. What can we do for you?
I had a phone call regarding...
Hey, by the way, Stephen, how's the chin?
How's the chin?
Yeah, everybody saw on the blog today that I gave you a right cross. And
you're such a big guy and picking on such a little guy. I mean, that's not nice. I mean, you're one of these bully, mean Calvinists.
I tell you, bully, mean, baby-eating Calvinists. That's definitely me. There's photographic proof right there on the
right
front
there. So I,
well, we
and I got wet.
We appreciated you having you on the cruise.
Oh, thank you. I really said we had a great time. So I guess I encourage all those that didn't go, save their money for the next one.
Well, we hope to have some announcement and news about that in the not-too-distant future. But anyways, you received a phone call.
I didn't receive a phone call. What I wanted to do was basically ask a question that was brought up during the debate with Shabir Ali with the passage in Luke 13:33, the prophet in Jerusalem.
Mm-hmm.
And exactly where he was going with that, he actually brought up the same question with Tony Costa on Thursday. I was he and Shabir. Well, this was more of a dialogue than the debate, but it was the same question with that.
And
I was
wondering
what he was.
Did he make any comment?
How to respond to that?
Did he make any comment on it with with Tony?
No, he brought it up like he did with you.
Hmm. Yeah.
The prophet can't die outside of Jerusalem.
I'm not certain where he was going with that. My assumption at the time was he was just trying to present another attack upon the consistency of Scripture based upon the idea of taking outside of Jerusalem to be a technical phrase, but then to say, well, but Jesus did die outside of Jerusalem, as if that somehow was some major point. I had never, honestly, and I suppose I could have missed it, but I doubt it, I had never heard him raise this issue with anyone else before. And
I've never heard it either.
Yeah.
I never heard him bring it up.
No, I hadn't either.
The number of Muslims I've talked to bring it up.
Yeah, I had never heard it. And I told Tony as soon as I got back from the cruise I said, he asked how it had gone, and I said, well, he threw this thing out, which I had never heard of before. So it's funny that he brought that up with Tony. At least he was aware that might be heading his direction. So I don't know, because what's unusual is certainly Shabir would be able to have access to even liberal commentaries, and even liberal commentaries would recognize that the idea of Golgotha being outside of Jerusalem is a technical point without any merit. I mean,
okay.
I honestly don't know why he'd do that. And he would know that in his own Quranic studies, that the utilization of especially a major city, for example, there's Mecca, and then there's the environs of Mecca, and in some instances, you would have a very specific reference to Mecca and the city itself entering into the city or something like that. But in other instances, the environs around Mecca would just simply be subsumed under the same general concept. So he knows that that's the case. I don't know why. It did not seem at all relevant to the thesis. I mean, it mentions, a prophet perishing outside of Jerusalem, but you know, maybe there's something that we're just not getting that, that he never expanded upon. He didn't expand upon it with Tony.
Well, what I found was that even with the dialogue in Hamilton on Thursday was that he just throws so much dust up in the air, and you know, I mean, it's more or less preaching to the converted rather mm-hmm. than the or the choir rather than actually answering the questions, and he really didn't address any of the points that Tony brought out with it. So I think it's the same thing, and of course he did the thing that he did with me with the five revisions of the Gospel of John, which I'd never heard that one before.
Well, no, he brought that up in the debate as well, and I'm like, well, what? And I didn't get a chance to say this. I think I mentioned this afterwards up in my room with the folks that gathered up there. Was when you make that kind of an assertion, not only are there people who likewise present theories about the stages of development of the Quran, and hence he'd have to, I guess, accept those without any evidence, because there's certainly no documentable evidence of these theoretical early forms of Luke or John or anything else. But beyond that, he would have to admit that he cannot provide any kind of documentation from the first century. And when he was debating Mike Lycona, and Lycona kept citing Dunn on the early nature of the creedal statement, 1 Corinthians 15, eventually he made this statement. He said, well, that's just one scholar's guess. That's just an individual's guess. Well, the vast majority of the things that Shabir likes to bring out, like the Gospel of Thomas earlier than Mark thing, is the guess of a single liberal scholar. And there's no historical foundation upon which to build it outside of, well, I just accept this one particular scholar as having a tremendous amount of insight. Well, you know, you can't have your cake and eat it too. You either have to stop taking one scholar and expanding that out to scholars have discovered as if these are facts. Or if you're going to do the, well, that's one scholar's opinion, then be consistent about that and recognize, you know what, I pick a lot of different scholars and they're not really consistent with one another, but I string them all together and that's the entirety of my argument against Christianity, but I don't accept it to be used against Islam. I mean, that really summarizes, I think, the main criticism that I've always, I mean, go back to the earliest, you know, search on the name Shabir on my blog. And from the first time I mentioned anything about him, the first time I listened to a debate, the first time I listened to a presentation, and everything that I've written, it has been the inconsistency in the utilization of sources. He uses one standard for the New Testament and a completely different standard for the Quran. And if you just step back and go, what does that mean? It's very clear what that means. If you don't use the same standards in your argumentation, I'm sorry. That just means it's a sign of a failed argument. There you go.
Well, what was interesting was that, I missed Thursday night's DL, but I did listen to the archive, and I was listening to the Bart Ehrman, and he was talking about reading the Gospels horizontally, and I said, now, where have I heard that before?
Oh, yeah. Well, I think they may be either using the same source, or they may be, it may be a situation where Shabir is known of Bart Ehrman for a long, long time. I think
it just seems that this is where he's getting his stuff. And I mean, he also was bringing up about that. Well, maybe these liberal scholars have read the Bible and seen the inconsistency, and he's sort of blaming the fault on the Bible. But what about we could quote the liberal Muslim sources who no longer believe the Quran because they read it and examined it. He wouldn't accept that.
No, well, and not only that, there'd probably be a whole lot more of those liberal sources if it weren't for the fact that they would die in Islamic countries. And that's just a fact. There's lots of history of scholars running afoul of a Taliban-like government and finding themselves under a pile of rocks.
Yeah, we saw what happened to Salman Rushdie.
He's not even in that context. He's
no, he's
yeah,
not a scholar.
It's amazing.
I mean, he writes something that criticizes the Quran, and there's a death warrant placed on him.
Yep, I hear you. Well, Steve, again, thanks for being on the cruise and putting up with, well, you know, I had to put up with your abuse all the time, too.
Yeah,
so it
well,
wasn't.
I mean, you look so nice.
Yeah, just watch it. Watch it. I'm still in channel here. I still
yes, I
got us, you know.
So am I.
For
well, thank you so much.
For now, thanks a lot.
Okay,
God bless. Bye bye. Stephen from Toronto, who puts up with all of our mocking and ribbing because Stephen isn't. He's not a bad speller. He's a sort of bad typist. And so there are times when what appears in channel is a little bit on the humorous side. And sometimes when I have good self-discipline, I don't say anything. And then other times I do. So and he puts up with it. So we appreciate him. All right. Let's continue on here. Let's talk with Mike. Hi, Mike. How you doing, Mike?
Okay, can you hear me all right?
I can hear you. I guess I'm just noticing a delay. It gets to it eventually, but I'm using a new computer to do my stuff here, and it just sort of moves slowly to put you on the air. So
not necessarily updated technology.
Well, I got to admit, this is my little tablet, the third incarnation. The first two got ripped off, and so it's the third incarnation. It's only got 512 megs of RAM, so these days that's pretty tiny for a computer. So maybe it's just going, do you really want to do that? I don't know. But anyways, what can we do for you? Yes, sir.
Anyway, yeah, I just wanted to bring you up to speed. I told you, I had talked to you a few weeks ago. I had met a imam here locally in Fort Myers, and he and myself and a buddy of mine had met finally. And one of the topics that had come up was this issue of, hey, we have three original versions. Now it's up to three, by the way. Usually, it started off as one, but now it's up to three original versions of the Quran.
Oh.
And I asked him, I said, well, give me the background. Exactly where are these original versions located? So he had given me the places. He said there's one in Istanbul at the National Museum of Turkey. He said the second version is in Uzbekistan. I hope I said that right. And the third is in China. And that one was just recent. He said you can actually check this out on al/Jazeera, JAZZERA.net/English.
Yeah, that's the Al Jazeera Arab television network that we hear about all the time, which is just right on the cutting edge of scholarly acumen. No two ways about that one. Yeah.
But he was, I was like, okay. Yeah, he was pretty emphatic about it.
Oh, I'm sure that he is.
He was.
The problem is that Muslim scholars are currently spinning in their offices going, oh, please. You know, it's that sounds a little bit to me, honestly, and we shouldn't be surprised at this. We have King James only folks who, you know, say some pretty wild-eyed things. You know, yeah, God re-inspired the Bible in 1611. Why not? You know, and so in reality, there's a lot of argumentation as to whether the very earliest manuscripts that we have would, from the Islamic perspective, be pre or post Uthmanic. Obviously, when I refer to Uthman, I'm referring to the Uthmanic revision around 655 or so. And, you know, there's definitely early on, there's no question about that. But the idea of being original, a serious Muslim would have a hard time with that. Is he actually saying these are the ones that Uthman did, or is he actually going back to Muhammad himself?
Muhammad himself.
Really?
I remember what you said to me. You know, you said basically, hey, there's no serious Islamic scholar who would accept that assertion.
No.
And I did bring that up to him. I said, well, is there any Islamic scholar or Muslim apologist that would, in fact, agree with that? Oh, yeah, they're out there. I said, well, can you give me any names? Well, I can't think of any right now, but I'll get some for you. So I did ask him.
Oh, well, you know, did you see my debate with Hamza Abdul Malik?
Yes, absolutely.
Well,
I'm sorry, we have not seen that. That's coming up. We will be viewing that.
Okay, however. Well, then you're going to see that that's not the first time that that defense has been used, because Hamza Abdul Malik's entire assertion was that every text that I raise that teaches the deity of Christ is a later interpolation. It's a later corruption of the text. And so I just went to the only thing you can do in a debate like that. I'm like, okay, Where's your evidence? Show me a manuscript. Well, they're there. Well, can you name one? No. You don't need to be asking about that. I can't name one off the top of my head right now. I said, well, look, I've got a critical edition, Greek New Testament. Can you give me a manuscript that doesn't have these verses? Well, they're there. I just, you know, they're there. I said, well, can, you know, scholars say, so? Okay, can you name a scholar? Well, no, not right now. I can't name a scholar. But there are scholars who agree with me. And you're just like, wow, I'm not going to get an answer here because there is no answer. And,
right.
And everyone obviously knows there's no answer, but yeah.
Yeah, I had read that too. Matter of fact, in preparation and dealing with maybe talk to this guy, should something come up, but I read that little portion in your Scripture Alone book.
Right.
You included that.
Oh, I did. That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. Yeah.
That actually was pretty good.
Well, it's fun to actually listen to it and to actually watch it, you know, because it's one thing to read it, but another one to actually see someone sitting there in front of an entire audience going, oh, they're there. And you know he knows they're not there, but he's saying it anyways. It's amazing.
Well, at any rate, I wanted to mail something to your P.O. box if I could, unless you have this. He actually provided me something to read. It's called The Truth About Jesus by Dr. Now, it's M-A-N-E-H, Mana, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
Dr. Mena Hamid Al-Johani. Familiar with the name?
Yeah, I think I may have seen it on the answeringislam.org website.
Okay.
But I could be wrong about that. I mean, I'd like to take a look at it because I have a huge text. I have it in here in the studio right now, but I have a very large text put out fairly recently here in the United States, which is sort of a compendium of their anti-deity of Christ arguments.
Okay.
And it's about 400 or 500 pages long, so this would probably be along the same lines, I would assume.
Well, this is just a little booklet. It's only 23 pages long, 24 pages long. And I asked him if I could photocopy it. He said, no problem.
Mm-hmm.
And so I wanted to send this to you, but I wasn't sure if you already had it. So if you
Go ahead. Okay. Take a look.
All right. Might be worthwhile to take a peek. Okay, very good.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir. Take care.
All right. God bless. Bye-bye. Well, the drop button works well. But, okay, I'm gonna choose this one. And once it's selected, let's see if we can get Kendall in Iowa up. One click, two clicks, three clicks, four clicks. Nope, it just... There. Did you have to do it? Okay. All right, Kendall.
Hello, James.
Hello, how are you?
Doing well, and yourself?
Doing all right.
Great. Hey, I ordered your debate on purgatory.
With?
The Catholic apologist.
Well, I didn't think it was with a Mormon apologist.
No.
Father Peter Stravinsky.
Peter
Stravinsky, yes. Because I've also done one online with the Robertson Jenis.
Okay. And I'm going to show it on Sunday nights at our church. Because Sunday night I did talk about the latest, you know, the Pope came out saying, you know, the Roman Catholic Church is the true church, nothing new there.
Right.
And just to prepare them to engage. We live in a community with a lot of Catholics here in the Midwest. So my question, I'm calling in, if you were to, you know, you've got purgatory, the Pope, the, you know, all the sacraments, but in dialoguing with Catholics, what do you think is the most effective way, what topics should you bring up with them to get the dialogue rolling? Is it justification? I'm talking about your average Catholic.
Well,
purgatory or...
Well, your average Catholic. It would sort of depend a little bit upon whether you're talking about your average Catholic who only goes to church a couple times a year type average Catholic, which is more of a nominal cultural type Catholic, or whether you're talking about an average Catholic who really does attend services fairly regularly but isn't necessarily a apologist type or something along those lines. And in both instances, honestly, in the Roman Catholic controversy, I presented as the key message that you wish to communicate and that's going to get you to all those other subjects eventually is the issue of peace, whether a person truly has peace with God, a peace that is based upon something outside of themselves or a peace that is based upon their performance, their constant running on the treadmill of sacramentalism. To keep it in place. And I think that works with any person in whose life the Holy Spirit is actively bringing conviction of sin. I mean, if you're talking to anybody, I don't care if they're a Catholic or a Mormon or a Muslim or a plain old pagan, and there's no evidence the Holy Spirit of God is bringing any enlightenment to their eyes at all, you're not going to get anywhere with them, no matter what your approach is. But
I agree. I like to
focus on the issue of peace and how a person can have peace and the impossibility of a person having true peace within Roman Catholicism. And as long as the person really does understand the Roman Catholic faith and they've experienced repetitive confession of sin and going to Mass repetitively, and yet they are not perfected thereby, that gives you the grounds upon which to contrast what it means to truly be justified and hence to have peace with God, Romans 5:1. What it means to have a perfect sacrifice of Christ that perfects those for whom the offering is made, Hebrews chapter 10, or whether you're stuck with the beginning of Hebrews chapter 10, a repetitive sacrifice that never perfects anyone and hence is incomplete in and of itself, which is what all Rome really has to offer to us. And so you can go a number of different directions from that general subject of how a person has peace with the Holy God, and very quickly find out if this person has a very low view of sin, or a very high view of the sacraments. You can get some information pretty quickly that'll give you an idea of which direction that you're going to go. Obviously, a more cultural Catholic, and especially one who's grown up within a more conservative Catholic background, issues like purgatory are going to be worthwhile, because that's something that many of them fear, especially older Catholics. Any older Catholics that lived in the 50s and 60s and stuff well know what pre-Vatican II was like in regards to the concept of purgatory and things like that. And what you'll see, if you've not seen the Stravinskis debate, honestly, to me, aside from some of the amazing things that took place, especially during cross-examination, one of the drawbacks of the debate is that it illustrates what happens when you have an individual who, quite honestly, is just a little bit arrogant. And when Stravinskis had first been contacted, remember, he's got two PhDs, teaches at Ivy League schools, He has editor of the Catholic Answers, written I don't know how many books on Catholic apologetics. You would think that if anyone would know the value and necessity of preparing, it would be him. But clearly, he hadn't read anything I had ever written, anything I'd ever said. When he was first contacted, he said, "Who would I be debating?" And they said, "James Weiss." "Oh, he's harmless." And so he walked in there, and literally he's making a presentation where he's talking about a dialogue with Jimmy Swaggart, as if Jimmy Swaggart is in the slightest bit relevant to me. And the result was just a massacre. But in the course of the massacre, you see, I think, more clearly than any of the justification debates we've done, the vast difference between the Roman Catholic view of grace and justification and the biblical view. And so on that level, it's extremely useful. And whatever you do, don't skip the audience questions at the end.
I happened to watch the first and the last one.
Okay, so did you see Pay Me Now or Pay Me Later?
Yeah, I watched the Q&A part of you guys, where you did get into the sacrifice of Christ.
Right.
Did it perfect us for, you know, once and for all by his work? And how he I don't think he really ever came back and answered that.
No, uh-uh.
Because he still talked about payments for sins. I thought the question was interesting, where a guy brought up about Tobit.
Yes, yes.
The payment.
Yes.
And he didn't disagree with that.
Nope.
He was saying, yeah, that's charity. That's
yeah.
So
yeah, it really I thought was one of the best debates, not in that. On the subject itself, he did a really good job, because he melted down in 1 Corinthians 3. I mean, clearly, that was one of the most amazing experiences of all my debates was, you know, here's a guy clearly thinking, you know, Rome's view is, you know, we've got all the scholarship and all the rest of the stuff. I'm just sitting there with my Greek New Testament. Let's walk through this text. And he couldn't do it. I mean, every question I'd ask, his position was just falling apart all around him. And then when I ask him, who's the blessed man? Well, I hope I am. First he says, Jesus is. I'll say, so Jesus is the one to whom God will not impute his sins? And so you could tell he rethought that one real quick and came back with, well, I hope I will be. And, I mean, talk about illustrating really what the whole thing's all about. So,
and I am coming at it from a reform point of view, doctrine of election, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
And so I know, you know, where to defend the faith. And so I was just wondering, you know, purgatory for me seems to be one of those topics that we'll get into justification. How do we stand before God and the whole idea of merit?
If they're conservative, if they are conservative and somewhat knowledgeable, if they are a cultural Catholic, I've had a lot of them go, well, didn't Vatican II change all that?
Okay.
And, honestly, they just go, you know, if they're in a really liberal parish, they're never going to hear about this stuff. Their priests are going to, if their priests are liberal, they're not going to be even bothering to talk about what the church still says. Then it becomes incumbent upon you to know the Catholic Catechism well enough to point out how often it talks about purgatory and indulgence and stuff like that. And that frequently in a witnessing situation is just too much time investment up front to try to lay a foundation. So that's where just going with the peace issue, you know, might be a little bit easier depending on, you know, where the person's coming from, which sometimes you can't tell, you know, in that type of thing.
And one quick question. I noticed you're revamping the shopping cart page on your website.
Yes.
And where you have listed there, I didn't know if you were going to add, like, you have the Great Debate 3, the Great Debate 4, but it doesn't really, when you look at it, it doesn't say what that Great Debate 4 is about. Which one deals with the issue of justification? I have the
Rich
one on purgatory.
Rich is now staring at the screen going, huh? Obviously, I don't actually order stuff, so he's pulling up the shopping cart as quickly as he possibly can in the other room going, I don't know. Does it say which was the debate was with? Who I was debating?
I think you have to click on each one.
Yes.
Okay.
And that brings up a description.
And it does bring up a description.
Okay. Yep.
Okay.
Yep.
Yeah. And so the one, we've got the purgatory one. You did one on justification then?
Yeah, unfortunately, that was with Roberts. I've done a couple on justification. The one with Roberts and Janice is number four. Is that Rich? Okay, one's it's all right.
Yeah.
St. Janice has a little bit of an odd presentation, so I'm not, you know, in the question and answer period, you do get into some of the stuff where he's saying like there will be sons of God in hell, and some of those things come up, but it's not nearly as clear. Honestly, I wish, and I make the call again, there are videos of a debate, the first debate I ever did on justification with Father Mitchell Pacwa in San Diego, but it's the Catholics who have the videos, and they will not distribute them. So we have the audios, you can listen to that, but you can't get to watch it, and I think... Do we have another? I'm trying to think if we have any other justification debates. I know I debated Jerry Matatix on the subject once or twice, but I don't think it was part of the great debates. So I think the rest of it's just all audio, and the only video one we have is with St. Janice, who's no longer really considered. Festigi. Yeah, but that's only, what, half an hour, 90 minutes? How long was that? There is one with Robert Festigi. It is 90 minutes. Okay, that was a fairly decent length one. Okay.
So it's your latest one, the great.
And of course, I got that information from the shopping cart.
Oh, thank you, Rich. Rich has put a lot of time into the shopping cart, so he's just wanting to make sure everybody knows you can click on things and see what it's about.
Yeah, it might be helpful when you first click on the shopping cart where it says the Great Debate 5, just to put in brackets or something, purgatory. Because
okay.
I am clicking on them and seeing which one.
Right.
Like I was looking at the Great Debate 10, you actually do get into purgatory, justification, all that in that debate. Is that correct?
Who is it with?
Rutland.
Oh! Yeah, well, we got into a lot of stuff with Bill Rutland. The problem is, within a week and a half afterwards, it was the Catholics that were throwing poor Bill under the bus. That was supposed to be on the issue of inclusivism, and so as a result, we did end up talking about all sorts of things, which would include the nature of justification, things like that, but not nearly to the depth that we did with Stravinskas, because we were supposed to be talking about, you know, what the modern Roman Catholic Church teaches about Muslims worshiping God and stuff like that. And so even though the Stravinsky's debate was pretty clear, there was really less of a fight put up by Bill Rutland than by Peter Stravinsky's. So,
and I mentioned Sunday night, would you say that Bill Webster's book on Matthew 16 dealing with apostolic succession is probably one of the best books on that topic then?
Well, yeah, I mean, Bill's work is great. Unfortunately, a lot of the books that are the best on the subject as far as real in-depth history just aren't really available anymore except in forms like Google Books and stuff like that. For example, George Salmon's work on the infallibility of the church. We have... Disputations in Holy Scripture available. That's from Soli Deo Gloria, isn't it? That's out. I think Salmon's is available through Google Books, actually, but again, that's, you know, not the easiest thing to read. So there are a lot of works that came out, but they're just not, all that easy to track down these days, unfortunately.
Okay.
All right?
I appreciate it. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. All right. God bless.
Bye.
I'm not sure if you... I did that. So, you have to put them on, and I have to take them off?
No, I did both.
Okay. Whatever. Don't ask me what's going on.
I don't know.
That's okay. All right. What did I have here? I've got two Mises in front of me, and I keep trying to make a move on a different computer, and that doesn't work overly well. Let me take some time today, given that it is October 30th, to say something about Reformation Day. I know that I never, ever, ever heard of Reformation Day until I went to a Reformed Baptist church. Up until that point, Martin Luther was a guy from the 1960s, pretty much so. And once I had some knowledge of the Reformation, then clearly this day, or tomorrow specifically, became much more important to me. Obviously, the commemoration of the posting of the 95 Theses is somewhat of a convention. Clearly, the Reformation didn't start that day because there is no start date to the Reformation. As is the case with almost all of church history, any major movement has all sorts of precursors that lead to it. There, from a human perspective, it could have started earlier, it could have started later. We don't know why the actions of a particular individual, such as Martin Luther, lead to the results that they do. It's a convention to look at this, but it's a convention that I think is a good one. Because we as human beings, we see in Scripture that God does have His people celebrate holidays, and that these are meant to commemorate things that God has done in the past, and to remind us of God's faithfulness over time to His people, and that He has continued to build His church. And clearly, October 31st, 1517 is an important day along those lines, but as in so many things in the history of the church, when Martin Luther woke up that morning, he didn't have butterflies in his stomach. He did a few years later at the Council of at the Diet of Worms, but he didn't that morning. When he went to the Castle Church in Wittenberg and on the doorposts where other things would be posted, he posted the 95 Theses. This was not something he woke up that morning and wrote. He had been working on these for quite some time. There was a development that led to it. And in fact, there are clearly discernible, historical movements and developments for hundreds of years prior to Luther that led to that fateful morning. When he posted those 95 Theses, he was being a simple academic. He was challenging someone to debate. And remember, this is pre-ESPN. This is pre-CNN. This is pre-almost anything. Printing has only been in existence for a small amount of time in Western culture at this particular point in time. And so communication, you know, we are so accustomed to rapid communication today. You know, I'm sitting here and I just pulled out my BlackBerry to see if Summer has texted me, because today is the first day she's back in Carter's class since I posted his last anti-Christian tirade. And so I'm sort of wondering if I'm going to get a text message, about today's anti-Christian tirade or something else. But people couldn't do that only a few years ago, let alone could they even dream of such speed of communication, let alone speed of movement, as we experience today. And so there are all sorts of developments, the invention of printing, the publication of the Greek New Testament, Erasmus's work, and Cardinal Jimenez's Complutensian Polyglot. The Renaissance was absolutely vitally important. The Reformation could not take place prior to the Renaissance, because it was in the Renaissance that you have, and the Crusades for that matter, because it's in that those two movements you have the creation of a middle class, you have a rise in literacy, you have a study of original sources, you have the creation of universities. All of these things come together to create the very soil in which the Reformation message germinates and creates the Reformation movement itself. And so Luther was the product of many, many, many movements coming together in that one particular point. And, of course, human beings would have no possible way of predicting where this would take place. I mean, from a human perspective, Wycliffe was a considerably better candidate to begin the Reformation than a Luther would be. Far more intellectually rigorous and things like this, but the time simply wasn't yet right. He is living prior to Gutenberg's invention, which Church eventually called Gutenberg's folly, because that invention was necessary to the spreading of the message. And up to that time, the Roman Church had utilized the fact that you couldn't get the message out to too many people, and once you kill the heretic, that's the end of the problem with the message, and then you track down his followers, and then all as well. So there were all these different movements that came together, and when Luther posted those things, he was simply doing what an academic did. It was back then, and you could, if you want to, one of the major differences between then and today, when major universities have a rivalry today, it is almost never because of their teaching staff. It is almost never intellectual in content. It is almost always physical in content. Here in the great state of Arizona, you have two major universities, and NAU is not a small university up in Flagstaff, but you have two major universities, Arizona State University, which I believe is ranked in the top 10 in college football at the moment, and the University of Arizona in Tucson. And they have a tremendous rivalry going between them in basketball, which U of A almost always wins these days, and football, which right now ASU is winning all the time. And, you know, they try to sneak in and paint each other's. There's a big A up on the mountain outside of the campus in Tempe, and they try to sneak in there and paint it the U of A colors before the games. And, you know, people have to go up and sit on the mountain all night and protect it and all this kind of silliness. And this is the nature of rivalries between universities. Back then, you didn't have football teams. You had the great professors from each competing university, and they would have debates, multi-day debates. And then after the debate was over, all the students would go out and party in the streets and have fistfights and drink way too much German beer. And that's what was college life, university life, back in those days. And so that's what Luther was doing. The 95 Theses were a call for reformation within the church. He was not looking at starting a new church. He was not looking at changing the political face of Europe. It was the farthest thing from his mind. He certainly lit the match. And the conflagration shocked even him. I mean, when the peasant revolt of 1525 takes place, Luther is just, he's beside himself. Because it looks like he has released absolute anarchy upon the land. which has to happen given the fact that up until this point in time, Rome, in essence, is still a sacral institution. The Church of Rome and government are intertwined, and it had been that way for as long as anybody could remember, and the idea of separating that and changing that, even Luther didn't have that idea. The first reformers were all magisterial reformers. They were sacralists. They likewise believed that the church and state had to be one, and that the state had the right to punish heretics and things like that. And in fact, within a very short period of time, after 1517, Luther is amenable to the utilization of the death penalty against the Anabaptists. And so even the Reformation itself, you know, we get this silly idea, and part of it's because we put out silly books, honestly, that have these dates in them. And we put these dates with certain developments. And so, you know, let's say Rome makes a dogmatic definition about something, well, like the bodily assumption of Mary, okay? So, you know, 1950s, you put that number there. And unfortunately, what we think is, oh, this is the day that it, poof, popped into existence. That's not the case. Obviously, even Marian dogmas that are very, very late, like the bodily assumption of Mary, still existed as a belief with somebody long before the dogmatic definition itself comes into existence. And so in history, all of these things are not as cut and dried as we would like to have them to be. To put on in a little chart on the page of a book someplace. But we do tend to look at it that way, and hence don't realize that things like the doctrine of purgatory, there are all sorts of precursor beliefs that had to come into existence before purgatory could begin to take on the form that it has today. And in the very same way, when Luther did what he did, he was riding on the crest of a wave of all sorts of different angles coming together, the rise of nationalism to where, you know, for a long time people viewed themselves as part of the Holy Roman Church first, and then where they lived was secondary. But now people were thinking themselves as Germans over against Italians, and the Germans didn't like the fact that the Italians would take their money to build pretty churches in Italy. That was an important element in the rise of the Reformation. Because Rome had not really been seeing that and had not really recognized just how strongly people felt about that. All sorts of these things came together on October 31st, 1517, and no one that day had a clue that date would become important to generations to come. It's doubtful that during Luther's life anyone really attached any particular importance to the date. But when we look back through history, we see these streams coming together into this large flood of waters, this force of the change of history. What unleashed it? Where did all of a sudden the whole movement all of a sudden change course and all of a sudden things come to the surface? Well, clearly, in the ministry of Martin Luther, you have the standing before Charles and the beginning, the fact that the Holy Roman Empire itself basically is religiously destroyed. You literally have wars breaking out because you are having a fundamental change in how government is being viewed, how religion is being viewed. And as long as your overriding government for hundreds of years has been a religious one, you have a change in religion, you have a change in government. And, you know, some people say, well, not all the results of the Reformation were good. Well, that's true. I mean, secularism is a part of the result of the Reformation. I mean, as long as you had Rome in charge of everything, you couldn't have secularists because they'd be tied to a stake and burned. That was changing. No one can argue that wasn't going to change. And I would argue that you look at Roman Catholic nations today, and they're just as secular as the northern European nations are. You know, look at northern Italy compared to southern Italy. It's like two different nations as far as worldview goes and things like that. So when we think of October 31st, obviously I look back at it and I go, here is a point in time where God acts decisively, and there were many great Christian men and women prior to that time who gave their lives in the hopes of someday seeing something like that taking place. And there would be many who would give their lives thereafter to continue it. Tremendous stories in regards to, Wycliffe's bravery and Jan Hus at the Council of Constance and things like that. These were important people. And before Luther, they died not seeing what they hoped would come from their own ministries. But we are the heirs of that Reformation. The fact that we have the freedom to preach the gospel today goes back to that point in time. And it's should be shocking to us that in the very same land where once it was the Roman Catholic Church that sought to silence any and all expression of opposition viewpoints, now it's the secular state doing the very same things that the inquisitors did only 500 and 600 years ago. Do we not learn from history? Do we not see these things repeating themselves? Evidently, people in Europe are not seeing that, and they obviously need to, and they need to do so very, very quickly. So if people ask, oh, do you have a special Reformation Day service? Well, not so much in our church, but I frequently do speak on the subject of Reformation Day and things like that. I haven't actually decided if possibly on the Lord's Day I might do something a little different in the adult Sunday school class and possibly review some of these issues. I don't know. I should mention that for those of you listening live today, if you tune over after the Dividing Line to WNYG, listen to Iron Sharpens Iron, you'll get to hear Jim Swan, our own T-Quid from the Prosopologium blog, will be on discussing Luther with Chris Arnzen. So if you want to hear much more about Luther, then you can tune in Iron Sharpens Iron. And hopefully, when I walk into my office here in a few minutes, my computer will be faithfully recording Iron Sharpens Iron, because it would look really sad if we didn't get this one recorded because Jim Swan's going to be on. So hopefully you all can tune on over there and get another hour of discussion of Reformation Day issues and probably hear a lot of similar things that I've just actually said. At least I would hope so. But with much more brilliance, as Jim Swan likes to say. So that's the WNYG. You can if you go to sharpens.blogspot.com, there will be a link there that you can follow to listen live, or if you can't listen today, obviously I will be uploading the file right after the program is over, so you can listen to it as well. I will listen to it myself, because who knows, maybe I'll get to I don't get to sit around reading as much Luther as I would like. As I mentioned on the blog this morning, I was till late in the evening last evening doing an Arabic tutoring session and looking at the Tanween and being utilized on to differentiate. In fact, did you know that if you have an adjective and a noun, and the noun's indefinite and the adjective's definite? Oh, never mind. You're just giving me the, you really shouldn't be doing this. Yes, I'm actually enjoying my study of that. It's good stuff. Well, thanks for listening to The Dividing Line today. We will be back on Thursday afternoon. I didn't even get to my Patrick Madrid clip today, and I had some other stuff queued up. But, hey, that's all right. Lord willing, we'll get to tackle it on Thursday afternoon. See you then. God bless.
I'm
Dividing Line has been brought to you by Alpha and Omega Ministries. If you'd like to contact us, call us at 602-973-4602 or write us at P.O. Box 37106, Phoenix, Arizona 85069. You can also find us on the World Wide Web at aomin.org. That's aomin.org, where you'll find a complete listing of James White's books, tapes, debates, and tracts. Join us again this Thursday afternoon at 4 p.m. for The Dividing Line.